Arguments 14. How Religions Go Bad, 4. The third of Charles Kimball's warning sign of religion becoming evil is its establishment of an ideal time. What does this mean? Well, in all three major Western religions, it is common to dream of a future better than the present, to look forward to an era of universal peace, prosperity, and justice. Orthodox Jews await the coming of the Messiah to bring it about. Conservative Christians expect the second coming of Christ, the Battle of Armageddon, and a thousand-year reign of peace to follow. Muslims long for the prophesied worldwide Islamic state where all aspects of life, economic, commercial, military, spiritual, social, and familial, come together seamlessly under Islamic law, and none lack faith in Allah. Most believers are happy to wait for these end times, drawing comfort from the belief that they are promises that came from God. Others are less patient and take it upon themselves to precipitate the new age, the ideal time, in their own lifetimes. According to the theology of theopraxy, we should have some sympathy for the latter group, which is at least proactive. It wants to make the world a better place. But we should be wary of propounding an ideal time, achievable in any real-time frame after or because of our deaths, or anyone else's death, or by means of any single world event. There is no expectation of such in the theology of theopraxy. There is only the commitment to make today better than yesterday, and tomorrow better than today, indefinitely and by small increments. Subscribers to the theology of theopraxy set no deadlines, expect no showdowns, relish no Armageddons, and long for no final reckonings before God. They pursue incremental evolution, meaning life of greater quantity, variety, complexity, and degree of organization, here, and here, and here, and here. Open-ended evolutionary gradualism of this kind may lack apocalyptic drama, but it also diffuses the urgency created by visions of imminent consummation, an urgency that easily comes to involve the trampling of others in a rush towards what is actually a myopic and fevered vision without the novelty, loveliness, or surprise that true evolution generates. Which brings us to Kimball's fourth warning sign. Arguments 15, How Religions Go Bad, 5. Kimball's fourth warning sign, believing that the end justifies any means. Whenever a key event or place or religious or political doctrine, quote, in effect becomes an end, some people within the religion become consumed with protecting or achieving that end, and zealous believers become blind in their single-minded defense of it. That was Roger Kimball. Perhaps the best example of this is the exclusion of followers of other religions from sacred sites. In India, Muslims and Hindus have massacred each other over a disputed site in the city of Ayodhya. In Israel, dozens of sites are contested by Muslims and Jews, especially in Hebron, or Al-Khalil, and also in Jerusalem. Rights to their stewardship, as well as the right to exclude others from access, have come to stand for the legitimacy of entire nations, in defense of which any sacrifice is thought to be justified. Our theology has no sacred sites, not historically, for obvious reasons, but also not in principle. Everywhere a person can go is potentially sacred, since God can come into being anywhere, and everywhere good can freely be done. God does not wait at churches, synagogues, or mosques to be called, nor does God hover over memorials. In appearances that are as spontaneous as they are short-lived, except in memory, God takes place in classrooms and hospital rooms, on quiet streets and far-off villages, in parks and basements, in cars and on trains and on planes, in office buildings, bedrooms, kitchens, and dining rooms. There is no need to memorialize contact with God and then hallow the place where that happened, since God taking place is not so rare and momentous an occasion. You are probably bringing God into being right now, or were just moments ago. This is not to say that God comes to life everywhere equally, easily, or often. There are some places that, by virtue of their design and history and purpose, are more conducive to ethical actions within them than others. What typically goes on in these places is important too, of course. A jail is not a school. An abattoir is not a nursery. But other things being equal, their physical design and condition can make a difference. Clean streets, watered gardens, and painted walls say something about their owners and about what has been achieved. Spaces that are naturally lit and harmoniously proportioned are dignifying rather than demeaning, as are rooms that are functionally and comfortably fitted out and cared for. They affect the mood of everyone in and around them, putting people subtly on their best behavior. These environments increase the chances of God, quote, taking place there, and the programming, financing, designing, building, and maintaining of them are in themselves good doings. The defense unto death of sacred sites is not the only example of religion putting ends before means. Another is the defense of religious identity, even of faith itself. If you worship a God capable of killing non-believers, then you or your descendants will someday kill non-believers. If you worship a God capable of killing for his ends at all, then sooner or later you will kill for your ends, although you will say it is in his name. The truth is, however, that immoral means never justify moral ends and vice versa. Moral means never justify immoral ends. Thou shalt not kill means God shall not kill either, notwithstanding biblical evidence to the contrary, and notwithstanding Quranic urgings to convert or kill infidels. According to the theology of theopraxy, God is our not killing. A given war might be justified, perhaps it is a war of self-defense, but it can never be a holy war, which term, in the view of our theology, is an oxymoron. A theopracticing Jew, Christian, or Muslim will find no reason in his or her faith to stumble people of other faiths on account of their beliefs, or to harm any creature whose life is no imminent threat to their own. This brings us to the fifth and last of Kimball's signs of religion's turn to evil, declaring holy war. Arguments 16. How religions go bad, 6. Declaring holy war. Until recently, the term holy war referred to the Christian crusades of the 12th century, sometimes to the French wars of religion in the second half of the 16th century, and to the conflict in Northern Ireland in the 20th. From the late 20th century onward, however, the term holy war became largely identified with Islamic fundamentalism and jihad, a word used equally by Palestinians in their struggle with Israel and Al-Qaeda in their attack on all things American. Given the state of the world at the time of this writing, I should like to concentrate on this last sense of holy war. Islamic scholars like to point out that holy war is a careless translation of the word jihad. As one scholar writes, jihad has the literal meaning of exerting our best and greatest effort to achieve something. It is not the equivalent of war, for which the Arabic word is qital. And as the same scholar explains, jihad simply means fervent effort. These are his words. Jihad has a much wider connotation and embraces every kind of striving in God's cause. A mujahideen is one who is sincerely devoted to his or her cause, who uses all physical, intellectual, and spiritual resources to serve it, who who confronts any power that stands in its way, and when necessary, dies for this cause. Jihad in the way of God is our struggle to win God's good pleasure, to establish God's religious supremacy, and to make God's word prevail. This passage is intended to allay fear and clarify the meaning of jihad. One cannot help but take note, however, of its talk of supremacy or of its condoning of coercion and self-sacrifice unto death for the cause. What cause? There are two, said the Prophet Muhammad, and therefore two forms of jihad, the greater and the lesser. The greater jihad is overcoming carnal desire in oneself. The lesser jihad is spreading the truth to other nations that, quote, there is God, no God save He, the Almighty, the Wise. That's Surah 3:18 of the Quran. It is the second lesser jihad that may well involve action on the battlefield. One wonders whether Muhammad looked to the Bible's Joshua for inspiration. After all, the Israelites did not take Canaan with sweet words. Unless you think there are no encouragements to violence in the Christian canon, consult Matthew 10:34 through 39, John 8:24, and 2 Thessalonians 1:7 through 9. From a theology of theopraxy point of view, there is something admirable about jihad, taken to mean sincere effort in the cause of making God happen, or making His word prevail. After all, waiting for God to do something for us runs counter to the idea of God being in our hands. But the theology of theopraxy offers a path to more peaceful evolution and away from war because it does not identify obedience to God with moral decision-making. Moral decision-making, if it is genuine decision-making, represents obedience to no one. It is a free action. It is our taking responsibility for doing good, either just because or as an expression of our love of God, but certainly not out of fear or submission to God. Here is the crux of the problem. If God is almighty and all-wise, as God is considered to be in all three Abrahamic faiths, and yet we must act without waiting for God to approve of our every action, then we need pre-approval from God, preferably for whole classes of action. Where is this pre-approval to be found? Why, clearly, in the pages of our sacred books, in the words of God's prophets. But this modus operandi, when used to exclusion, is precisely what prevents our own ethical intuitions from evolving. If we cannot serve God in our own modest way and know that that service is authoritative, or rather authorial, then we will never do better than our ancestors. Having read, having listened, and having thought about the good, having come to see God as good in action, whatever else God may be, we realize that serving God in our small way has to be enough. For this is how God acts, modestly, joyfully, without cataclysm or violence, through you and me deciding on the best thing to do for all life, and then, counting ourselves neither first nor last, doing it. Holy war will never be fought by soldiers who believe this. The theology of theopraxy respects all religions, not just out of good citizenship, but because it operates at a meta level. It is a meta-religion, if you will, and as such it may well serve as a bridge between them, as a place of common concern. What religion, after all, is against good doing? But human nature being what it is, we must finally consider the possibility that being identified as a theopracticianer could someday, somewhere, be seen as subversive. In some communities, a theopracticing Jew, Christian, or Muslim might come to be perceived as a person with divided loyalty and therefore a potential traitor. And this in turn could lead to witch hunts, tests of true faith, the requiring of special oaths, and so on, precisely because differences in dress, speech, and behavior between true believers and theopracticing believers would be all but non-existent. Should we be concerned? Absolutely. It would not be the first time that paranoia has turned trust of the brother into fear of the alien. The alien all the more menacing for bearing an uncanny resemblance to the brother. It happened to the Jews of Germany in the 1930s. It happened to the Muslims of Sarajevo in the 1990s. Perhaps the best way for subscribers to the theology of theopraxy to avoid this eventuality is to be frank if asked about the nature of their faith. I say, if asked, because most congregations neither ask about nor care what their members truly believe, on the principle that this is a private matter and unprovable in any case. Besides, they themselves don't want to be similarly challenged. In secular contexts, the question doesn't come up. But in certain towns and neighborhoods, it might be best to stay away altogether from religious communities that put too much stock on true belief. This all but concludes my discussion of whether the theology of theopraxy is as vulnerable to going bad in the hands of its enthusiasts as the great religions have been in the hands of their enthusiasts. I hope to show that it is not. Of course, by way of solution to the whole problem, there is also eschewing strong beliefs generally. Beliefs about anything, that is, except the inadvisedness of having strong beliefs. Paradox aside, the solution would surely have some power to prevent evil, as would removing from religion any attachment to sacred sites and any trace of a mission to persuade others of its truth, and so on. But the result of eschewing strong belief per se could also be to render the religion in question harmless through insipidity, or through turning it into a completely private affair, with every believer a container of pent-up, inexpressible convictions they are too afraid to act upon. There is a better way. Better than strong belief in a strong God, better than weak belief in a strong God, and better than weak belief in a weak God, I suggest, is strong belief in a weak God. In a God who needs us in order to be realized, a God who is only good, who loves all life-loving life, who is easily thwarted, who is manifest as a pattern of actions we can cause as well as witness. This is what the theology of theopraxy recommends. It's a matter of education. Strong faith in a strong God, I suggest, is called for by people who since childhood have been taught to fear the evil all around or the devil in themselves. To people who feel they could succumb at any moment, meeting strength with strength recommends itself as the best strategy. At once atavistic and familiar, the conclusion is inescapable, given the premises. Hence the number of born-again believers in prisons. Hence the courage of religious zealots, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim, which is not really courage, but fear. Fear of a reproving God, fear of evil, fear of themselves, fear of going to hell, and or anxiousness to reap reward in heaven. And what happens when evil wins and we sin grievously on this belief? Why, then we turn to a massively forgiving God. And so it goes, ricocheting between extremes. Strong faith in a weak God, on the other hand, is suited to people who feel the goodness within themselves. It is for people who, for one reason or another, and probably since childhood, have little fear that evil or the devil could overwhelm them at any moment, who do not believe that they presently need or soon will need forgiveness of a large sort, and who think that good could prevail if they just put their minds to it, or if we did. They may be wrong, of course, and they may be in need of forgiveness rather more often than they know. But the criticism some would level against them, namely that in the face of a large evil, for example, a Hitler, they would lack the passion to resist or the confidence to win because they had no strong God on their side. This criticism is not accurate. The path of nonviolence is born of quiet confidence, confidence not in the thunder-like power of a God who will smash the evildoer, but in the rain-like power of unaccountable human goodness to soften the hardest hearts. As I discussed in Reflections 7 and Arguments 20 and 21, the theology of theopraxy is not for everyone. For its propagation, it cannot turn to fear, but must rely on the moral example of its subscribers and of the attractiveness of the ideas you find in these pages. Arguments 17. Five wise sayings. It is our choice of good or evil that determines our character, not our opinion about good or evil. That's Aristotle, the Nicomachean Ethics. Without virtue, God is a mere name. Plotinus, the Enneads. If anyone were to show me that apartheid is biblical or Christian, I would burn my Bible and cease to be a Christian. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, 1984. Who is wise? He who learns from all men. Who is mighty? He who controls his passions. Who is rich? He who rejoices in his portion. Who is honored? He who honors others. Ben Zoma. Who shall do the good, and when? If not me, then who? Answered Rabbi Hillel. And if not now, then when? Rabbi Hillel. We realize that what is an existential question for us is an existence question for God. God did not give us freedom on any simple one-way understanding of give, i.e. God to us, done. Rather, we realize freedom, our freedom, is prerequisite to God's existence. God must be chosen. Once we understand this, God gives us freedom redoubled. Arguments 18. Ludwig Feuerbach, God as projection. The argument that God is a projection of human virtues onto the universe, making God in a sense a creation of human beings, was common among European intellectuals of the 19th century. It was a view most fully worked out and most forcefully propounded, however, by the German philosopher Ludwig Feuerbach. Only from man, he wrote, does God derive all his determinations. God is what man desires to be, namely, his own essence and goal, imagined as an actual being. This sounds like the theology of theopraxy, but it is not. For Feuerbach, the idea that God was a projection was both a liberation and a disappointment. The liberation was from the church of his day, whose power to define and impose moral behavior in God's name was already fatally weakened. The disappointment is harder to locate and more interesting to ponder. It can be seen in the very choice of the metaphor, projection. After all, compared to existing as an energic, agentic, autonomous, and intelligent being, existing as a projection could only mean existing passively, as a mere projection, as a shadow in Plato's cave, a chimera, a memory, or as a desire. In short, an illusion without self-determination. Compared to God of the Bible, the one who put the sun and the moon in the sky, the one who vanquishes armies with a blink, the one who giveth life and taketh it away, a God that is a human projection is as good as non-existent. Of course, to think poorly of human projections, to call them mere or illusory, is to betray a rather low opinion of humanity, qua humanity at the outset, not to mention a lack of understanding of the depth of the concept of information. This Feuerbach could not possibly have had, as it is a modern idea. In a truly humanist view, anyway, humanity is anything but pathetic, not at the outset, and not ever. Humans are wondrous beings, and although many of our projections are indeed flimsy and mistaken, many are not. Laws rule. Chess is real. And the tears we shed at movies are not false. Indeed, the phenomenon of movies is especially instructive, given how close to literally projection is involved. While the images on the screen are physically diaphanous in the extreme, mere patterns of colored light, the coordinated skills and painstakingly developed technologies that put those images on the screen are very real and very much a marvel. To call a movie merely a projection of light on a screen and therefore not real is to see only the last stage of what is actually a very real process of production. It is also to overlook the value and reality of patterns of behaviors, of gestures, of words, and yes, of images, light, sound, and action. The theology of theopraxy asserts that God, similarly, is no mere human projection, but a great human production. There is a world of difference between these two formulations. Before Feuerbach, Hegel, his teacher, had made his own arguments about what I want to call not the projection, but the production of God. It was Feuerbach who reduced production to projection. For Hegel, God comes into being as absolute spirit by a lengthy succession of Aufhebungen, meaning upliftings or transcendences in the course of natural and human history. Absolute spirit was no mere projection, no mere pipe dream or imagined thing, but a non-material entity, vast and subtle, produced by historical events, and then becoming itself instrumental in shaping, that is, in producing, other events. Absolute spirit, or God, struggles to realize itself in life. Created, creating, and perdurable, both responsible for and growing with human civilization. Ohne Welt ist Gott nicht Gott, he wrote. Without the world, God is not God. With his theory of God as projection, Feuerbach was subjectivizing, indeed overturning, what Hegel thought quite real. Feuerbach's was an atheology, Hegel's a theology. The theology of theopraxy and Hegelian philosophy agree in this much. 1. That God's very existence is bound up with intelligent and conscienced human life. And 2. That the relationship is that of mutual dependency. Our theology, however, does not see God or absolute spirit, either created or creating, as a superior entity located somewhere or everywhere in some other dimension. It offers no world soul hovering over humanity like the breath of a crowd on a winter morning. Although stimulated by speech and text and the witnessing of exemplary behavior, in the theology of theopraxy, the idea of God occurs to and in individual human beings and becomes actualized as God only in their actions. Everyday behaviors that preserve, honor, and promote life in everyday space are God's form and substance in full each time. No oversoul is required, and no undersoul either, no source, beginning, or ground. Arguments 19. From Feuerbach to Buber. Presenting Feuerbach to an English audience in 1855, Marion Evans, soon to write as George Eliot, argued that the traditional form given to the love of God has the unfortunate effect of setting God between man and man. It had come to the point, she wrote, that God, quote, instead of sharing and aiding our human sympathies, is directly in collision with them. Instead of strengthening the bond between man and man by encouraging the sense that they are both alike the objects of his love and care, God thrusts himself between them and forbids them to feel for each other except as they have relation to him. More to be trusted, Evans went on, is the love between people that takes place without reliance on divine inspiration or divine intermediation. Those who show love, sympathy, courage, and fairness do not need God, and they do not need religion. Practice these virtues and you somehow already have God, or if not God, quote, himself, then what God wants. Following Feuerbach's lead, Evans was taking Reformation arguments to the gates of Protestantism itself. Not only did church dogma and priestly behavior get in God's way, but so does God, or at least the God of Protestant Christianity in her day. Nietzsche was to agree. Some 50 years later, the German Jewish philosopher Martin Buber, who was a student of Feuerbach's and a scholar of Hegel, wrestled with the same thought. Is the Judeo-Christian God a human projection, and a counterproductive one at that? This could not be. In his seminal work, I and Thou, which we also studied in Arguments 2, Buber offers an alternative. God, he said, is the eternal Thou, the Ur-Thou, as it were, who looks at us from all people, creatures, and things that we treat as having subjectivities and interests of their own. Deeper than sympathy and prerequisite to love, the I-Thou outlook betokens respect. Respect born not out of fear, but out of recognition of the equality of the other's being to our own. This is why, for Buber, God should never be theorized as a or the generalized it, i.e. as some impersonal system of forces that created the world or nature. This would be deism. To regard God as in any way an it, that is, without his own subjectivity, is to miss encountering God. To regard God as having instrumental value to us, say, in enforcing obedience to moral rules or providing ultimate justice, is also to miss encountering God. Although God can be spoken of in the abstract, God is not God until God is spoken to in the depths and fullness of another creature's being, addressed grammatically in the second person, which is to say, as you or thou. For Buber, God is the eternal thou behind all immediate thous. Indeed, God is the entity with whom only I-thou relations can be had, and in whom, and in some sense, all earthly I-thou relations take place. This is how Buber puts it. Quote, extended, the lines of relationship intersect in the eternal thou. Every single thou is a glimpse of that. Through every single thou, the basic word addresses the eternal thou. The mediatorship of the eternal thou of all being accounts for the fullness of our relationships to them and for the lack of fulfillment. The innate thou is actualized each time without being perfected. It attains perfection solely in the immediate relationship to the thou that, in accordance with its nature, cannot become an it. Men have addressed their eternal thou by many names. Buber here takes theism about as far from deism as it can get. For Buber, God is radically personal. God is experienced in authentic relation with other sentient beings, and not in general prayer or in contemplation of the design of the world. And yet, by positing God as the generalized or absolute thou, Buber retains an element of Platonism still. Like the form of the good, God, whole and one, waits in eternity. He waits for us to approach and encounter him through ethical, compassionate, desireful relationships to others. Most actual human relationships only dimly approximate an encounter with God, and few can deliver it full strength for any length of time. Nevertheless, there is no other way to God. Here, the theology of theopraxy has a worry. For if human relationships can deliver, as it were, an encounter with God, then they can become to be seen as a means for having that experience. The I-thou relationship itself becomes an it, which is related to in an I-it way. and this has to weaken Buber's program. Cast in Buberian terms, the theology of theopraxy would offer this instead. God is produced in and by the either-or relationship itself, with both parties chemically necessary for the reaction to take place. When being in an either-or relationship with another creature becomes a doing, a concatenation of actions and interactions that make the relationship live and life-promoting, it produces God. It is God. The I-Thou relationship must express itself in words and deeds. It cannot be a theory or a feeling alone, and it cannot be thought of as a means to an end. This is why I say that humans produce God in their relationships with the world and each other, not just project God onto the world. This is not the conclusion that Buber draws from his own schema. He did not set aside belief in a transcendent, autonomous creator God, approachable in person, in persons. Buber had found a way to weave God into human social life and yet leave God above and beyond that. For Buber, I-Thou relationships are like windows onto God, windows that allow participants in but not observers of that relationship, sightings of God's visage, God's radiance, God's throne, metaphorically, of course. Nevertheless, the idea that people produce God by how they act in relation to one another and to other creatures is, I believe, inherent in the assertions of the book I and Thou, a book that was both a critique of Feuerbach's projection atheology and a concession to it. Perhaps this is why Buber remains such an attractive figure in modern religious debate, beloved by Christian God is love theologians and by existentialists, religious humanists, Unitarians, and Reform and secular Jewish thinkers alike. It will be difficult for Orthodox believers of any tradition to accept that people produce God by their relationships and their actions. But once they understand that the assertion intends no blasphemy, there is room, at least, for tolerance. The theology of theopraxy is happy to be cast as a peculiar religious philosophy that helps set up the conditions under which the creator God of the great monotheistic religions could reasonably be thought to exist and act. A devout but open-minded believer could say to a subscriber to theopraxy, "Look, if you want to believe that man produces God, go ahead. You'd be wrong, but God won't mind just so long as you do his will." And the subscriber to theopraxy could say to the Orthodox believer in return, "Look, if you want to believe that God created the universe from nothing, sees all, does all, meets out justice, hears prayer, speaks to prophets, and manifested himself in Jesus, go ahead. Just do good." Anyone who observed the everyday actions of an exemplary theopractitioner would see only a dignified, humane, courageous, and loving human being who might be of any or no standard religious persuasion. The truth is, however, and as I have said many times now, it remains to be seen whether the theology outlined in this book can yield a kind of faith less prone to co-option and corruption than traditional faiths have been, and a way of life in this scientific age more likely to preserve, honor, and promote all life. I think it can, and I think that the God of Abraham, should he exist as described, would be pleased if I were right. Arguments 20. God as production. Many acts of production are aimed at creating larger, longer-term, or more complex goods than we could produce by ourselves. A factory, a building, a business, a movie, a research paper. We often call these goods projects. So, by analogy, we might ask, is God, according to the theology of theopraxy, a human project, the way, say, the elimination of global poverty is a human project, or the construction of a transatlantic tunnel is a human project? In other words, is God the result of a social collective effort? Will we have, quote, produced God only when God's kingdom is realized? It would seem that if subscribers to the theology of theopraxy are willing to say that human beings produce God at all, they should be willing to say that producing God is a collective project, the greatest project of all. But they are not, and this for reasons that have wider implications. For there are problems with construing God as a social project. Chief among them is the problem of free riding. When God or his kingdom is seen as a collective effort, free riding becomes a major temptation. People begin to let others do the work, like pray or be devout or do good deeds, while slacking off themselves. Free riding is not a problem for the theology of theopraxy alone, of course. It can readily be found operating within traditional religious frameworks at both the family scale, where typically a grandfather or mother's religiosity is felt to cover everyone else in the family, and also at the larger social scales, where typically a charismatic leader or holy person is allowed or is elected or is authorized to represent everyone else to God and to pray for them, in both senses of the word for. The solution to this kind of free riding, as Martin Luther saw, is to make communion with God a personal project. In this way, individual success or failure at communicating with God would have clearly personal consequences. No longer would a caste of priests represent ordinary people to God in return for material support. Rather, how fate shone upon an individual would depend on his or her relationship to God, a relationship that was in their hands, and of course God's, to establish and maintain. This was progress. Unfortunately, Luther's strategy, by its very logic, weakens feelings of co-fatedness or mutual dependency, and thus reduces enthusiasm for projects that really do require everyone to pull together in order for anyone to succeed. After all, if the only relationship that counts is the relationship between an individual and God, why not go it alone? Partial, failed, and even dangerous solutions to this problem have been many. For example, propounding that it is God's will that you cooperate with others. But the problem remains. How can group spirit be fostered while championing an entirely private relationship between each individual and God? If it ought not to be done by seeing God as a common project, or by saying that God, as traditionally conceived, wants us to work together, what remains? This, we could realize that undertaking certain real earthly projects, eliminating poverty, say, or restoring a woodland, or going to Mars, can give rise to God over and over again, if and as working on these projects lengthens and enriches individual lives, or reduces involuntary suffering, both as they are done as the consequences of having done them. Here we produce God without making God the project, or a projection, and without claiming that God will reward us individually for showing solidarity. Whether we act together or act alone, God is the good we do, contribution by contribution. Cooperation simply amplifies the good we can do individually. To be sure, enjoying the fruits of others' labors is one of the most rewarding experiences of living in community, as is being the recipient of generosity or being witness to another person's unforced decency. These are free rides of a sort, where the element of quid pro quo is suppressed. One simply receives. With maturity, however, the desire to provide the same experience for others begins to exert itself. The desire to give back. To add some of one's own labor to the tide of good happenings, to help the stranger just because. One acts to bring about God oneself. In his book Being and Nothingness, Jean-Paul Sartre elaborated the distinction between two modes of being. Being for itself and being in itself. Humans, and perhaps some higher animals, he said, exemplify being for itself. They look out for themselves, and they look out for favored others. They want things. They have projects. They know they are alive and they fear they will die. Inanimate objects and most lower forms of life, on the other hand, just are. They have no ambitions. They offer no justifications. They are content in their own existence, no matter how long or short or rich or poor that existence might seem to us. Incapable of deception, they exist authentically in themselves. The physical universe exists in just this way, and so, we must think, does God, who lacks nothing, who is his own foundation, who just is. Tragically, quixotically, being in itself is what human beings long to partake into, says Sartre, but they cannot. Jean-Paul Sartre, quote, "The ideal of a consciousness that would be the foundation of its own being in itself by the pure consciousness it would have of itself is the ideal which can be called God. Thus, the best way to conceive of the fundamental project of human reality is to say that man is the being whose project is to be God. Whatever may be the myths and rites of the religion considered, God is first sensible to the heart of man as the one who identifies and defines him as man, as his ultimate and God's ultimate and fundamental project." Humankind's tragic project, says Sartre, is to be God, just as it is God's project, we tragically think, to identify and show us what it means to be divinely human. Both projects are doomed, says Sartre, for we cannot be God, and God, if he is, just is. Now some might say, how could anything said about God by so well-known an atheist as Sartre be anything but flawed, and perhaps deliberately so? The theology of theopraxy is sympathetic to Sartre, but it disagrees with him on one crucial point. To wit, man's project properly is not to be God, but to bring God into being, over and over again, by their free moral actions, and so to continue creating and evolving God in human history. For God is humanity creating as well as humanity created, whereby humanity, I mean not human beings as a species, but the opposite of inhumanity. God's project, to use Sartre's phrase, is not to produce humankind, but to produce kind humans, actual ones, just as our project is not to be God, but to give God life in ours. And there is nothing tragic or doomed about either of these projects.